Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati distinguished that there are 10 different groups of Apa Sampradayas, or 12. Sahajas, and the Bals, and the Owls, and the Jati Goswamis, Caste Goswamis, and others. There are all, you know, many categories of persons who think they're following Lord Chaitanya, but they're not properly following. So they've got some devotion, but the devotion is also mixed with a lot of material desires. And they end up committing aparads. So we have that category. And then we have those who have come to the Society of Pure Devotees, but they haven't been able to maintain the principles, or they've committed aparads against their godbrothers, and they've been dragged away by Maya. So also, again, and they're still trying to practice devotional service, even though they're having great difficulty. Again, Sakkama Bhaktas. We have not hard to find examples, even in our own times, of persons who have devotion for the Lord, but they're also having to struggle with material desires that are causing them obstacles. So, therefore, in our own time, we have to reestablish, our acharyas have decided that we have to reestablish the varnashram system, but on a transcendental basis, Daivi Varnashram. It's especially for those who have a hard time coming up to the standard of Krishna consciousness. Yes, ma'am? Yes. Yeah, just like the Krishna consciousness that ISKCON is representing, which is mostly standard of sadhana bhakti. We certainly have a hard time coming up to the standard of pure spontaneous devotion, Vaguriga bhakti. Most of us are not ready for that. And many of us are having a hard time even just chanting 16 rounds and following the four regular principles. And living with devotees. Many of us can't tolerate to live with devotees. So, therefore, to help, should ISKCON just be for a few people who can hang on? Or should something be done to make it possible for many more people to participate according to their own ability? Therefore, we've been told by our acharyas that we have to reestablish the eternal Varnashram system on spiritual principles to make Krishna consciousness available to a wider public and to help ourselves. Many of us are having problems. Especially those who can't follow the vows of initiation. For them, the rules and regulations of the social system Varnashram are very important. If you can't be to follow the four regular principles the Prabhupada gave and chant 16 rounds a day, that means to come to a standard of a Vaishnava Brahman. Vaishnava who's better than a Brahman. But if you can't do that, then better you take a position of Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra. And they should also be allowed to be considered participants in this movement, in their own way. And then, even for those who can follow the principles, they're also supposed to externally also accept the regulations of the Varnashram system. That we've already been given the ashrams. So every member of ISKCON, just like every member of the Gaudiya Mutt before us, when Bhaktisiddhanta established the original Gaudiya Mutt, we're supposed to dress and act according to our ashram. And it's different. Being a brahmachari life is different from grihastha life or sannyasa life. Different standards. So we just add to that the four divisions of occupational divisions of the varnas, then we have a complete system. And the devotees, even the practicing devotees, the ones who do follow the regular principles, they should also practice this Daivi Varnashram regulations. If we're struggling with material desires, it will help us. This will give us support to have a position in society. I can't be a Paramahamsa. I'm struggling just to chant my rounds and not fall down. So to be given a material position, a secure position in society, gives us support. Okay, I'm a Kshatriya. I can't pretend to be a Paramahamsa or even a Pukka Brahman. I'll just do a good job of being a manager. Or I'll just do a good job of making money and supporting my family and trying to serve Krishna that way. So you accept your material position, that gives you security to go on peacefully with your devotional service. And even those who aren't having particular difficulty practicing sadhana bhakti, you know, still to set an example for others, they should also, you know, accept a material position. And we do that. You know, most of, you know, Prabhupada did not encourage for our ISKCON that we become Babaji's, Abhadutas. We should, you know, maintain our material identity as Brahmachari, Sannyasi, Grihastha. And he wants that we also establish, even inside our, internally, in our ISKCON society, that we establish these different varnas. Of course, that has to be gradual. Who wants to be labeled a Shudra? Nobody. It'll take generations before it'll be considered respectable to be called a Shudra in ISKCON. Everybody wants to be a Brahmin. Now, come on, I got initiation, I'm chanting 16 rounds, why can't I can be considered a Brahmin? So I don't think it should be established by putting labels on, you know, giving everybody a test and you get a label stuck on you. You're a Shudra, you're a Kshatriya. It has to develop naturally, voluntarily, over the course of generations. But it's necessary. It's what's required to organize things on a more generous basis that they can engage the whole world, not just a few people who can somehow hang on. Okay, I think we move on to verse 15. Anyway, this is the... I don't think this is off the topic. I'm trying to present this ancient conversation as something of relevance. And the point of this whole class is to connect it to our current situation. Try to find the relevance of it to our own situation. Yes? In verse 14? Yes. Yes. Definitely, Kardama Muni is going to achieve perfection. That's described later on in chapter 24 of this canto. You know, how he goes back to Godhead. Yeah. And he's definitely on the right path already. He's, doesn't have much further to go. He's got some material desire and he's embarrassed about it. He's honest about it, and the Supreme Lord gives him his mercy, and he's able to relatively quickly rise above that by practicing devotional service. That's how it works. Be honest, admit your limitations, accept a practical position according to the guidance of the Supreme Lord and his representatives. Practice serving God the best you can, and you'll become perfect very quickly. Then, everything's accomplished. There may have been a little bit of embarrassment and struggle along the way, but you've achieved perfection. Then that's the goal of life. Because there's no doubt that Kardamun is on the road to perfection. By the end of this canto, he'll achieve it. Okay. Okay, we look at verse 15. And now he gets down to, okay, I'm sorry, you know, those who have material desires and approach you, the Supreme Lord, for those fulfilling those desires, they're very foolish. And I'm like that also. And here's my desire. So this is what he presents in the next verse. Tata sachaham parivodukamaha samana shilam Grihameda dhenum upeivan mulam ashesha mulam durashaya kama dugangripasya. Therefore, desiring to marry a girl of like disposition, who may prove to be a veritable cow of plenty in my married life, to satisfy my lustful desire, I too have sought shelter of your lotus feet, who are the source of everything, for you are like a desire tree. He's using this metaphor of kama dukkha. Of course, that dukkha, we're talking about a cow giving milk. So the kama dukkha is the surabhi cow. In Goloka originally, cows don't just give regular milk, they give whatever you want. You milk the cow, and whatever you want comes out. But he says here, Kama Duga Agripa, the tree from which you can milk all desires. So this is the Kalpaturu, this is the desire tree. So there's desire trees and desire cows in Goloka. So the Supreme Lord is the original tree that yields all desires. He's the tree, and all existence are like the root, the branches and the fruits, leaves of that tree, all God's energies. And nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam eko bhuvanam yo vididati kama. There are many living beings. God didn't just create material energy to enjoy, but he created the living entities, autonomous living entities, who have free choice to choose to serve him or not. And then if they choose to serve him, then there can be a loving exchange. If you just create robots, machines, or mechanical and material energy to manipulate, you may get some pleasure from that. But God sees the opportunity, the potential for much more pleasure by having autonomous living beings who can voluntarily submit to him. And then there can be love, loving exchange. But Krishna, he created all these, he manifested from himself all the conscious, eternal living entities, nityo, nityanam, chetanas, chetananam. He's the one original, conscious, eternal living being, who unlike everybody else, has the power and the responsibility to fulfill the needs and desires of all the other ones. Eko bhuvanam yo vididati kama. He's satisfying everybody's desires. So he's a desire tree. Just like this mystical tree of Goloka, you can pick anything you want as a fruit off that tree. Krishna is like that. Whatever you want, Krishna will arrange for the fulfillment of your desire, spiritually or materially. So he's the original desire tree. And desire cow. But he's now mixing up the metaphor intentionally for irony's sake. He's saying, I want a wife who will be the desire cow of my family life. Husband, ideal, imaginary conception of family life. The wife is supplying fulfillment of all desires. Of course, that's a very ironic contrast. The Supreme Personality of God is the original fulfiller of all desires. And he's asking for a nice girl to fulfill his desires. Anyway, this is the embarrassing, or the ironic position he's put into. He's just being honest about it. Look at me. Such a fool. Let's see what I have here. At least Karna Muni is going to the Supreme Lord with this desire. He's not going to some demigod. Shukadeva Goswami recommends, if you want a nice wife, go worship Uma, the wife of Lord Shiva. Dampatyartham Umam Satim. If that's your desire, you want to have a good family life, a nice wife to enjoy family with, then worship Uma. She's the ideal wife of Lord Shiva. She has the power to bless you for that. Karna Muni didn't go to worship Parvati to get a wife. He knows, he maybe didn't read the second canon, but he knows the purport of it. Maybe he did read it. A few verses later it says, Akama Psarva Kama Uva Moksha Kama Udara Di Tivena Bhakti Yogena Yajeta Purushampanam. Whether you've got a lot of material desires, or Moksha Kama, or you're a jnani, you want liberation, or maybe you're more fortunate than that and you're actually free from material desires, whichever category you're in, best thing to do is yajeta purusham, offer your worship to the Supreme Person. He'll give you what you need and want. Whether you've got material desires or desire for liberation, or you're actually free from desires, doesn't matter. Tivrena bhakti yogena. You should enthusiastically. Tivra means sharp, like a sharp razor's edge. So with very intense devotional service, you should worship the Supreme Lord, no matter what your motive is. Kardama is intelligent. He knows that. And therefore, he didn't go to some demigoddess for a wife. He went to Lord Vishnu himself. This is Prabhupada's explanation. I'm just repeating what Prabhupada talks about in the purport to this verse. And he also mentions in the purport that if you worship the Supreme Lord, even with material desire,
You'll gradually
become purified to the point that you can become a pure devotee. No matter how bad your material motivation is, if you have the intelligence and the honesty to approach Krishna for the fulfillment of your desires, then your contact with Krishna through pure devotional service will raise you to the level of a pure devotee. And you'll rise above these desires. You'll be able to give them up. That's the strategy of sadhana bhakti. It's also the strategy of the varnashram system. It's the same purpose of gaining the perfection of attaining pure devotion. Just as sadhana bhakti is the direct means, and the varnashram system is the indirect means for those who can't take the direct means. Spontaneous raganuga bhakti is the goal itself. It is the perfection. Sadhana bhakti is the direct means to get that perfection. And performing, accepting a position in the varnashram system and performing sacrifice, that's the indirect way to gradually come up to the point that you can practice sadhana bhakti. Okay, let's look at verse 16. Did we pass around? Okay, that's it.
Prajapatis teva cha sadhi shatantya lokakilayam kamahatonu badhaha aham cha lokanugato vahami balim cha shukla nimishaya tubhyam.
O my Lord, you are the master and the leader of all living entities. Under your direction, all conditioned souls, as if bound by rope, are constantly engaged in satisfying their desires. Following them, O embodiment of religion, I also bear oblations for you who are eternal time. So, Prajapatis, he's calling Lord Vishnu Prajapati. Prajapati is the term usually applied to the sages like Kardama and his brothers who are responsible for populating the universe. They're called the lords of creatures because they're the fathers. Well, the father is the master of the household. So they're the fathers of all the praja, all the population of the universe, forefathers. But he's calling Vishnu Prajapati, the ultimate master, the ultimate father of everybody. And what's the relationship? That everybody has to serve the master. Everybody's serving the Supreme Person. Either consciously and voluntarily, or unconsciously and involuntarily. Just like the metaphor here is the oxen who are tied by a rope to a grinding stone, and they have to walk around in a circle. Ashram at Govardhan, there was a reconstruction of this old palace, and to use traditional materials, they ground lime, and they built the walls. It's not ordinary plaster, but it's lime plaster. So the lime had to be prepared on the spot. They built a big kiln for cooking it. But first they had to grind the lime. So it was done by oxen, walking around in a circle, pulling a stone or a wheel around the track. And that was in the track was the line that was being ground. So like that's the metaphor. There's ox, or several oxen, tied up to pull some stone around in a circle. They've got to do it. You know, they can't just decide, well, I'm taking the day off. If they don't walk around in a circle, they'll be beaten. They'll be forced to do it. Like that, everybody is forced. Everybody's going to serve Krishna whether they want to or not. If we don't serve Krishna spontaneously in love, okay, we're thrown into the material world. And Maya takes us over and forces us to serve Krishna. Every creature in the world is serving the purposes of the Supreme Lord. All the work being done in the world, you know, the animals foraging for food, the tigers looking for some small animal to jump on, this is all Krishna's service. Indirectly. It's all for Krishna's satisfaction. Everything is happening in the creation. Everybody's serving Krishna, but most of them are doing it unconsciously and unwillingly. Like this ox tied up in the rope and he has to go around the circle. So everybody, the idea is balim. Is it a word balim here? Yeah, balim. Everybody's carrying tribute for the pleasure. Tribute is offering for the satisfaction of the Supreme Person. We come to this world trying to satisfy our own desires, but we're made to satisfy Krishna's desires, one way or another.
And then Kardama calls, in the last line, he calls the Supreme Lord Shukla. Shukla, I see what Prabhupada gives us the word for it, synonym, or embodiment of religion. The word Shukla also means white, it's pure. And then he calls him Animisha. Nimisha means blinking, eye blink. The person who doesn't blink his eyes, that's the Supreme Lord, the embodiment of time. You know, time never blinks its eyes, it never stops looking at you. On the American dollar bill, there's some funny symbols on the back. One pyramid there, the American dollar bill, and there's an eye on top of the pyramid. This is actually from the Bible. It was old Rosicrucian, the mystic Rosicrucians, they picked up the symbol, but it comes from the Bible. It's the some pyramid, I forget the place where they built the pyramid. The story in the Bible that the architects, were, you know, they had to drag the stones all the way up the pyramid, and as they got to the top of the pyramid, it was a longer drag, it was harder to get the last stones up to the top. So they said, okay, look, we built this whole thing so high, who can see the top anyway? Well, we won't bother with the last stone. We'll just, you know, it's too much trouble to get it up there. Nobody's going to see. But the moral of the story is God saw it. So there's, you've got the picture of the eye of God on top of the pyramid. You know, I see you guys, you left the stone off. That is Animisha, unblinking eye of God. He sees everything. And he's the force of time, controlling everything. Now what this means is that Kardama, these are the qualities of a Brahmin. He's religious. He's ready to submit to the supremacy of the personality of Godhead. A Brahmin doesn't try to be the controller. Kshatriyas have a great tendency to want to control. They want to conquer the earth. They want to put everybody else under their submission. And that's for their religion. Okay. They can dovetail that desire to dominate to the service of Krishna. But Brahmins should put aside the desire to dominate other people and to control Krishna's energy. They should Brahmins' business is to recognize Krishna's in control and stop trying to be in control yourself. Otherwise, you're not a Brahmin. You're something else if you want to be a dominator. So Kardama has, you know, Brahmin like Kardama has to recognize that the Lord is the embodiment of religion. That means he controls everything. Everything's under God's control. Why do I have to try to be the controller? And he sees everything. He's this unblinking eye of time. You know, don't think that, oh, you know, if I don't control everything, everything will be chaos. God, he has everything under control. He's the supervisor of everything. These are the qualities of a Brahmin that Kardama is showing here. He's showing his honesty and admitting his own limitations and honestly confessing his own embarrassing situation. Humility, honesty, freedom from the desire to be the dominator, these are qualities of a Brahmin. Here's Prabhupada asks in the purport. Last point that I'll stop. Why didn't Kardama ask for liberation? He could have done that. You know, Vishnu's here. You can ask him anything you want. Certainly, you know, you can ask him for liberation. He didn't do it. So, it's explained, Prabhupada explains, not everybody is competent, ready to be liberated. And Kardama, as an honest, humble Brahmin, admits it. You know, he wants liberation, but he knows it's not time yet to ask for it. Later on, he'll meet Vishnu again, chapter 24, and he'll get his opportunity to ask for perfection. Conditioned souls in the material world are bound by the laws of nature. If they're honest, if they're brahminical, then instead of pretending to be better than they are, more advanced than they actually are, and pretending to be liberated, they'll honestly abide by the Vedic standards, by the rules and regulations of the Vedic system. And they'll actually become elevated to liberation, but gradually. Okay. Any questions?
Say like there's a signal that was unnatural.
being? You mean being inappropriately determined? Just, you know. Yes. Well, really, you know, ultimately, honesty means to satisfy Krishna. You know, you can have a material concept of honesty that doesn't satisfy Krishna. Just like Yudhishthira didn't want to tell a lie. He just couldn't. I mean, it was against his nature. And then Krishna asked him, you know, you got to tell, you know, the only way we're going to kill Drona is if we tell a lie. Tell him that his son Ashwatthama is dead. Then he'll give up and we'll be able to kill him. And Yudhishthira refused. He said, Krishna, I can't do that. I never told a lie in my life. So that's inappropriate honesty. Yeah. The non-devotees, they say that Yudhishthira's chariot touched the ground after that because he told a lie. But our acharyas explain, because he hesitated to do what Krishna asked him to do. Therefore, his chariot touched the ground. So honesty, real honesty, means to adhere to the desire of Krishna. That's honesty. To, you know, to deviate from Krishna's desire is dishonest. So we have to have not a material concept of honesty. But, you know, the way to be honest is, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, I don't know. I, you know, my ashram life is not working out. Should I change? Go to your spiritual master and consult, or to some senior Vaishnava and consult. That's honesty. Not to speculate in your head or whimsically make up your own mind, but go and take consultation. That's honesty. And we find out Krishna's desire by consulting with our guru or with other Vaishnavas and with Shastra. Yes.
Have you experienced in a society of the past, someone may face a gods, which appears to be maybe a day and the world might be found?
Yes.
They do very well for a while because they actually might fall because they still have some material desires.
Yes.
So I don't really understand this.
I think we have to understand it that, especially in the beginning of this movement, Prabhupada encouraged doing this, taking sannyas, although it was a great risk, but for the purpose of preaching. Yeah. It's a battle with Maya, so we have to even risk our spiritual lives, you know, for the sake of spreading Krishna consciousness fast. So we should think about these, you know, our pioneers of the ISKCON movement who rose to high positions and then fell down again. We should actually be thankful to them. They actually sacrificed their own spiritual life, you know, for Prabhupada's service. It would have been safer for them to, you know, not take these risks and just make, you know, gradual progress. But this movement wouldn't have been established so quickly and so wide if these devotees hadn't taken these risks. And many of them fell down because of that, you know, because they tried to be something they couldn't. You know. Anyway, Krishna's satisfied and you know, they'll be saved in the long run. It's an act of sacrifice, a great act of risk and a sacrifice to do, you know, to take sannyas in Kali Yuga is very risky. Anyway, now ISKCON is becoming older. We have to sort of tone down our passion and not be foolhardy. You know, situations change. The world, you know, life changes. What's suitable in youth is not suitable when you reach middle age. You have to become more careful in your behavior. As you get older, it's like that. Our society also has to stop being so, you know, taking so radical risks. You have to become more, say, regulated. And more. So, you know, different, you know, it's kind of developed. Now it's not, sannyas cannot, you know, you can't just decide you want to be sannyasi and then the next day take sannyas. You have to wait 5-7 years. It's not so easy nowadays. Yes. Well, we just have to take the guidance of our acharyas. You know, although we can say, oh, look, you know, we're not qualified to be gurus. You know, but if Prabhupada says, please, all of you become gurus, what can we do? You know, given the request by this you know, perfect spiritual authority, even though I'm not qualified to be able to pretend to be a Brahmin, I'm just being a guru, but my guru asked me to do it, I have to do it. So what's honest and what's appropriate? That's decided by higher authority. It is, our business is just to carry out the mission of the great devotees who established this movement, Prabhupada and his predecessors. And just like Arjuna, you know, go ahead and fight. You may commit so many sins, you may kill your gurus. But aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami, I'll take the sins on my own head, Krishna tells Arjuna. Just go ahead and serve me. That's pure devotion. It involves taking risks, even sacrificing your own spiritual welfare. But we don't do it whimsically, we do it, you know, understanding, trying to understand properly what's the mission, what's the desire of our Vaishnava acharyas. If we just act as their servants, then we'll be protected, no matter what happens. If we act independently, then we have to take the actions on it, you know, for ourselves. But if we're just acting as the servants of Prabhupada, then whatever happens, you know, in the long run, we'll be protected. No? I mean, it's hard to, you know, I just simply accept that, but just that's the philosophy. Yes, ma'am? Yes? Yes. But he was. You know, he's talking very humbly. He's criticizing himself, but he's not as bad as he says. Yeah. He's actually, you know, practically on the point of liberation already. Yeah. And his desire, that material desire that he's harboring, is also what Krishna wants. Yeah. Krishna wants that Lord Kapiladeva will take birth in this world. And the part of Lord Kapila's pastime is that Kardamuni is supposed to be his father. Yeah. So it's not in as much Maya as he says. Okay. So we stop here? So thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam.
So the Vedas yesterday the metaphor was being applied to the Supreme Lord is the source of all desires. He's the original desire tree, the personality of Godhead. And then, sardonically, Karnama was expressing his own need to have a wife who will be the desire tree for his family life. Here, in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, in this verse, Nigama Kalpa Toror, third verse of the first chapter of the first canto, Suta Goswami, no, it's actually Vyasadeva speaking there, is saying that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the Vedas, which are a desire tree. So Bhagavatam has a very essential, integral connection, relationship with the entire corpus of the Vedic literature, with the original Vedas. And the Vedas are said to be a tree. This mystical desire tree. The desire tree has the quality that although people have all different kinds of desires, there are different individuals with different kinds of conditioning. The Vedas can easily fulfill the desires of anybody. It's got something for everyone. But the other significance of that metaphor of the tree, a tree is a single living entity, an organic unity. When you have a living being as opposed to just a random combination of inert matter, there's integral relationship between the parts. The roots of the tree, the leaves, the bark, the veins that carry the sap, they're all parts of one total organism which works together as a whole. All parts serve the whole, and there's a living intelligence holding it all together, controlling the whole, the entire whole. That's what a living organism means. If the presiding intelligence leaves, if there's death, then the organism very quickly disintegrates. So the Vedas are a single organic whole. There's one intelligence tying together all the Vedic literatures. It's not the way that modern scholars, Western scholars, see it, or even
Indian scholars nowadays. They see that all these Vedas were written, you know, a couple of thousand years ago by some nomads that came from Siberia. And then after that, hundreds, a thousand years after that, you know, the Brahmins gained their predominance over the other classes, and they wrote these other books, Puranas and other books, in order to keep the other classes subjugated, keep them in superstition. And then, you know, other books were written later on. Different times, different people wrote different books, and they all had different purposes. Different authors, different purposes, different consciousness. But that's against what the Bhagavatam is saying. You can take your pick. You can follow Max Müller and the other Westerners, or you can follow the explanation of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's your choice. The Bhagavatam says the Vedas are a single organic whole. There's one intelligence behind all the Vedic literature. And it's just different books. Just like a desire tree has to satisfy everybody. It's got to be able to produce anything as a fruit. You know, if someone wants an automobile, it's got to be able to produce an automobile. If someone else wants a house, the tree has to produce a house. So the Vedas have to be ready to provide anything to anyone. So there are different parts of the Vedas, just like different parts of a living organism, different limbs. There are different books, but they're all coming from the same intelligence. They're just addressing different audiences, and therefore they seem to be talking about different things. But it really, there's one purpose, one living organism is always working for one goal, to live its life. It needs water so it reaches down into the ground. It needs air so the leaves reach up. It needs light and air so the leaves reach up. But that those opposite tendencies are really one urge, just to maintain the life, to grow and live. Like that, the Vedas are serving its unified purpose in various ways, because there are various kinds of people that are approaching the Vedas, different audiences. Okay, and then within that organic whole of all the different Vedic texts, the Bhagavatam is being presented as, in this verse, Galitam Palam. The tree's got its roots, it's got its bark, it's got its various parts. But what's the glory of the tree? What's the real purpose of its existence? Is the fruit. You know, the flowers come, the leaves come, and the flowers come out of the leaves, and out of the flowers grow the fruits. And that fruit, that sweet fruit, that is the ultimate value of the tree. So in the hierarchy of values, a tree that bears fruit, edible fruit, is the most valuable and worshipable tree. If a tree can't produce fruit, if it can provide shade, okay, it's a second-class tree. And if a tree cannot provide fruit or shade, then it's third-class. And if a tree just has thorns and is just a trouble source of botheration, then it's fourth-class. So the fruit is the most valuable product of the tree, or part of the tree. And Srimad Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the Vedic desire tree. It's intricately connected to the original Vedas and all the other Vedic literatures, and it's the most valuable part. The essence, the distilled essence of all the Vedic knowledge is put into Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, that's the Bhagavatam itself saying that. If you don't trust the Bhagavatam, you can dismiss it. But we are devotees of Srimad Bhagavatam, if we're followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we'll accept that statement, I think. So, in doing research for this class, I was looking for some statements from Shastra that explain, especially, the relationship between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. So the Bhagavatam says many things. We can look in other Puranas and find some interesting things. But a prime source of very interesting statements about the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, their different positions, and especially their interaction, how the Brahmins and Kshatriyas work together, is found if we go all the way back to the Vedas. And so I dug up some quotations. We'll be looking at them over the next few days. I did not yet hand out. I have prepared printouts of these quotations and the translations, so you don't have to worry about writing them down as I say them. But I'm not going to hand them out immediately. Yeah. First, I'll introduce the statements in class, and then afterwards I'll hand out the sheets. Yeah, but you'll get them. I wanted to discuss, if anybody's not familiar with how the Vedas are organized, what the different kind of books are in the original Vedas. I just wanted to go over a brief outline of the Vedic Shastras, going back to the original Vedas. Especially these are the books in which we find relevant statements about the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas and how they work together. So, okay, I don't know if this is readable all the way to the back. The original Vedas are called Shruti, as opposed to more recent books. The original Vedas are eternal. They were not written by anybody. I think we discussed that already. How not even God should be considered the author of the Vedas, because they never were written. They always existed. Therefore, they're called Shruti. They're just what received through the simple succession by hearing. So Shruti means hearing. So they have a special authority. The Puranas and other more recent books, they're in a different category. They're called Smriti. Shruti has to be passed down from generation to generation without any change. Not even one syllable should ever be changed. And not only syllables, but in the original Vedas, the words have different intonations. A high, low, middle, like musical sounds. And they have to be preserved exactly. Otherwise, the text is corrupted. There's the example of Tvashta was sacrificing to get someone who would be an opponent of Indra, and because he wanted to beget someone out of the fire sacrifice who could defeat Indra, but he chanted one syllable with the wrong intonation. One syllable was wrong, not even pronounced wrong, but he just made it with the wrong musical tone. And because the word was changed, instead of getting a hero, he got a demon, Vitrasura. Because Vitrasura was killed by Indra instead of killing Indra. So this is the Vedas have to be preserved without changing. But they're considered the most basic authoritative source of all knowledge. If we can quote something from the Vedas that substantiates what we want to say, then it's really authoritative. Now, the Bhagavatam is our first authority, but the Bhagavatam itself goes back to the Vedic sources in many ways. Many things that are said in the Bhagavatam are echoes of what's stated in the Vedas. Just like in the second canto, the whole second canto practically is a commentary on the Vedas. Especially chapter 6, Purusha Sutta confirmed. Those chapters 5, 6, and 7, spoken by Brahma, are practically a verse-by-verse commentary on the Purusha Sutta. In many other ways, the Bhagavatam is echoing things that were said previously in the Vedas and Upanishads. So, anyway, in the Vedas, although the Vedas are not textbooks, you know, topical textbooks for high school or for university, in the Vedas there's lots of information about everything, but it's not presented systematically. It's not organized, you know, for classroom use. So if we want to find information about the social system, Varnashram, in the Vedas, we can find plenty, but it'll be scattered around, not arranged systematically. And there is. Some people who have studied the Vedas superficially, mundane scholars, say that there is no concept of the Varnashram system in the Vedas. Even there's no real clear concept of what a Brahmin is, what a Kshatriya is. Those divisions of society. That's not true. If you actually study the Vedas in depth, you'll find a lot of very explicit statements about the social order. But you have to look around. You won't find a chapter heading that gives all the information about Varnashram in one place. So in the Vedas, in the different sections of the Vedas, there is very interesting information about the social system. And then there are later books connected to the Vedas which are specifically on the topic of social organization. So here, I just wanted to explain. Of course, there are originally four Vedas. Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda. They're all composed of spiritual sound. But there's different kinds of sound. Just like ordinary language has different kinds of use. I can sit here and give a scientific explanation of something. Or else I can sit here and recite some poetry. Or we could be sitting in a court, and I could be the judge sentencing you to 40 years in jail. So those are different uses of language. If I'm just making a philosophical or scientific explanation, the language I use is not going to be the same if I was reciting a poem. So, similarly, the four kinds of Vedas are each speaking a different kind of language. That's really the basis of the division of the four Vedas. The Rig Veda, Brahmi, the Vedas are used in performing sacrifice. You can understand this different kinds of language by seeing how the different functions that these four Vedas play in the sacrifice. In a Vedic sacrifice, in a big Vedic sacrifice, not a small sacrifice you perform yourself at home, but an elaborate soma sacrifice, where you're supposed to have 16 or 17 priests, four priests from each Veda, and then an extra priest. They perform very specific separate roles. The Rig Veda priests are like the butler or the master of ceremonies. Like if you have an aristocratic get-together in your home and many important people are coming, then the butler will announce the guests as they arrive. Like that, the Rig Veda priest, the sacrifice is like a reception or a feast for the demigods. So the demigods are invited to attend, and as they come, their arrival is announced by the Rig Veda priest. The Rig Veda priests chant various hymns in glorification of the demigods. They're inviting them, come to the sacrifice. And they're announcing, here is Indra. He's the great slayer of Vitrasura. And here's his thunderbolt, his weapon, he has so many glories. Like the butler announcing, here is Lord so-and-so and his wife. So, certain kind of prayers, language of glorification, is recited in the Rig Veda. It serves its purpose, particular purpose in the sacrifice. But another important function is performed by the Yajur Veda priests. In the sacrifice, you have to take ordinary items and transform them into something mystical. Just like this in the Yajur Veda mantras serve that purpose. And the priests of the Yajur Veda, those who chant these mantras, are like magicians or sorcerers who can change, pull a rabbit out of a hat and perform various magic tricks. So the Yajur Veda priest, he recites a mantra, like for example, an ordinary clay pot, like you can buy for 15 rupees. Made by a potter, ordinary shudra, a person who's not even allowed to sit in the arena of the sacrifice. So you take the pot he made, and the Yajur Veda priest takes the pot and he says, you are the womb of Aditi. You are the womb of the earth. And so by chanting that mantra, he's transforming an ordinary clay pot into a magical element of the paraphernalia of the sacrifice. That pot is going to be used to hold the milk that is going to be offered to Soma in the evening in the Agnihotra sacrifice. So you have to transform the ordinary pot into a sacrificial pot by chanting that mantra. Yajur Veda priest, magician, sorcerer, transforms the material things into sacrificial paraphernalia. He creates the physical sacrifice by his mantras. That's like the judge in the court. The kind of language where you utter, you say something and it creates the reality. You know, I declare you, I declare you man and wife. By the judge saying that, or I sentence you to hang until you're dead. By saying that, the judge creates a reality. He has the power to do that. That's a special kind of language. That's the kind of language that you find in the Yajurveda. Magical language that creates a special reality. In the Samaveda language, okay, your guests come to the festival, you have to entertain them. So you hire an orchestra, and they play music during the banquet. Like that, the Samaveda priests entertain the demigods by taking the same Rig Veda mantras and putting them to musical, in a musical form. That's the Samaveda. And then the Atharva Veda is various magical incantations for dealing with obstacles. If something goes wrong in the sacrifice, then the Atharva Veda priest doesn't say very much. He's just sitting and checking, make sure nothing goes wrong. As soon as something happens that's not supposed to happen, then he starts chanting his Atharva Veda mantras to make up for the mistake. If somebody gets sick, there's different mantras for curing diseases. If some rakshasa comes to disturb the sacrifice, then the Atharva Veda priest has mantras to get rid of the demon, and so on. These are all so different. Anyway, different uses of language. This is the purpose of the four different Vedas. In each Veda, there are four different divisions of text. Every Veda has the original mantras, the original prayers, each for the four Vedas. Those are called the Samhitas. In addition, there are books in each Veda that explain ritualistically the meaning of those mantras. Those are called Brahmanas. Okay? But those are ritualistic explanations. And ordinary Brahmins, household Brahmins who are living in the villages and just performing sacrifices for material purposes, they're satisfied to study the Brahmanas and understanding the ritualistic meaning. But there are others, especially the renunciants who go to the forest, they want to know the more esoteric meaning, more spiritual meaning. So for them, there are higher explanations in the books called the Aranyakas. So each Veda has these different books. The sannyasis who go to live in the forest, vanaprasthas and sannyasis, they study the Aranyakas to get the more, inner meanings of the Vedic mantras. And part of the Aranyakas, included in the Aranyakas, are special books called the Upanishads, which contain the real deep philosophy. And ultimately, the explanation of Brahma, the absolute truth, is given in the Upanishads. Upanishads have another name, Vedanta. The Vedanta Sutra is simply a book that Vyasadeva himself wrote. Not Shruti, it's not eternal. The Vedanta Sutra is Vyasadeva's personal composition. Vedanta Sutra is Vyasadeva's explanation, commentary on the Vedanta, on the Upanishads, on the philosophical portion of the Vedas. Okay, anyway, those are the four books that make up each Veda. Four different kinds of books. Each Veda has its own. There's Rig Veda Samhita, then Rig Veda Brahmana, Rig Veda Aranyaka, and there is different Upanishads belonging to the Rig Veda, and the same with the other three Vedas. And beside that, there are different versions of each of the four Vedas. Different schools of Brahmins that live in different parts of India that have different versions of each of the four Vedas. There's four versions of the Rig Veda, I think 12 versions of the Yajurveda. 1,000 versions of the Samaveda, and they're all slightly different. Because the Vedas are not just, they're not limited. The same mantras can exist in different versions, and so therefore all these different schools or branches of the Vedas evolved. In particular, the Yajurveda has two basic divisions. The branches of the Yajurveda split up into two groups, the black Yajurveda and the white Yajurveda. I'm mentioning this because we're going to have some quotations from the different Yajurvedas. So black Yajurveda means not that they're worse than the white ones, but normally you have separate books. Books with the mantras, and then other books with the explanations, the brahmanas. Black Yajurveda is special in that in the one book, mantras and brahmanas are mixed up together in the same book. You know, you get a few mantras and then some explanation and back to another couple of mantras back and forth. It's mixed up, and therefore it's called the black Yajurveda. And there's another version of the Yajurveda where the books are kept separate, where the brahmanas or the explanations are all in separate books. So, like for black Yajurveda, it's Taittiriya Samhita. You know, like we're Vaishnavas, but we say that we're Vedic. So some Vedic Brahmin may ask us, okay, what Veda are you connected to? If you claim to be Vedic, you have to be connected to some specific school. So our answer is, we Vaishnavas are connected to the Taittiriya Samhita, the black Yajurveda. That's traditional understanding. Especially since the Taittiriya Upanishad and the Mahanarayana Upanishad are very, very Vaishnav in character. So the Vaishnavas identify with us. We consider ourselves belonging to this school. That's one of the major schools of the Black Yajurveda. Anyway, there's the Vedas. We're going to look at some interesting statements from the right out of the Vedas about Brahmins and Kshatriyas. And then, that's all Shruti. Besides Shruti, there's also books. Those are books that nobody wrote. Other books that different sages wrote, according to their personal understanding, and therefore it's not that the words are eternal, those are called Smritis. So in the original class of the earlier Smritis, there's one class, six corollaries of the Vedas, secondary sciences, like astrology and grammar. And one of those six sciences is called Kalpa, which means the science of how to perform the sacrifice, ritualistic details. So there are books, the original books in that category, written by various rishis, sages, are the Kalpa Sutras, textbooks on how to perform a sacrifice. And then there's three divisions of the Kalpa Sutras, three different kinds of books in that category. Shrauta Sutras, Griya Sutras, and Dharma Sutras. The Shrauta Sutras explain how to perform the big sacrifices, the public sacrifices, like Soma sacrifice that involves 16, 17 priests. So the big Vedic sacrifices are explained, how to actually do them, is explained in the Shrauta Sutras. And various rishis give their different opinions how to go about performing a sacrifice. Then there are other sacrifices that are not so important, not so big, that you perform at home. Like samskaras and the daily sacrifice that every Brahmin has to perform. These are home sacrifices. You know, these are in the Griya Sutras. And then the third category of the ritualistic Kalpa Sutras is the Dharma Sutras. And there, the special topic is how human society is organized. Here's where you find your information on Varnashram, the Dharma Sutras. How the different classes of people in the different varnas and ashrams, how they're supposed to behave. What's the rules of conduct? Dharma Sutras, these are the early books by ancient sages. And they're written in prose, in short sutras. Later on, other sages took the same information and rewrote them in verse form. And these are what we call the Smritis, or the Dharma Shastras. Like the Manusmriti, Manusamhita, is one of these Dharma Shastras. They're almost the same in content as the original Dharma Sutras, but the Dharma Shastras are written in shlokas, in verse. And there are maybe 55 or 60 existing different Dharma Shastras beside Manusamhita. And then there's one last class of literature, Artha Shastra, that's connected with the Dharma Shastra. We know, Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. These are the four goals of human endeavor. religious behavior, economic development, sense gratification and liberation. So the Dharma Shastras focus on, Dharma Shastras and Arthashastras both talk basically about the same thing, about how to organize human society, but from two different viewpoints. The Dharma Shastras were written by rishis, by sages, especially to be studied by Brahmins. The Brahmin's concern is how to maintain Dharma, religious, spiritual law and order in human society. So the motive of the Brahmins who were studying and teaching the Dharma Shastras is how to establish and maintain the principles of Dharma and get everybody involved, all the different classes of men. The Arthashastras explain basically the same topics, but especially for kings, for kshatriyas. A Brahmin wants to study Dharma to understand how to elevate human society, how to benefit everybody. A king studies the same topic to learn how to gain control over the earth. So the Arthashastras, they're written for kings who want simply to gain power and maintain it. So the same information, but presented in a very much more, with a different motivation. Like Chanaka Rishi, Chanaka Pandit, we know. His name is Kautilya, his original name. He wrote the Kautilya Arthashastra, which contains much of the same information as in the Manu Samhita, but it's very popular with kings who want to know, get down to brass tacks and find out how to gain power and control people. So, we were talking yesterday about how Kardama Muni, in his prayers, yes, I'm sorry? Yeah, at this point we can take some questions on, the, on what I said about all those. Some questions? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The Kalpa is one of the six Vedangas, one of the six Vedic sciences. And the topic of Kalpa is how to perform a sacrifice. In the Vedas, you just got a collection of mantras and some, you know, unorganized explanations of them. But how do you actually put it all together to make a sacrifice? That's explained in the Kalpa literature.
That's
smriti. Because it's written by various sages. It's not eternal. It actually has human authors. And the original, the earliest ones are the Kalpa Sutras. And then later there were... Oh, and there are three kinds of Kalpa Sutras. The explanations of how to do a Vedic sacrifice, explanation of how to do a home sacrifice, and then explanation of the laws for organizing human society. Yeah.
Wasn't the Veda unique in the beginning?
Which is?
The Veda unique?
One, yes. Yeah, I just didn't think we had enough time to discuss that, but I'll briefly. You know, yeah, the Vedas originally are one. Vyasadeva at the end of each, there's a different Vyasadeva at the end of each Dwapara Yuga. And he takes the one Veda and divides it into four. Now, what does that mean? There are four different Vedas. There are four different kinds of mantras, and they don't just merge into one another. There are four different kinds of language, and there are four different kinds of priests that study each of those four Vedas. But they're not, they're, the mantras are just out there in the ether, and various sages, you know, receive various mantras. It's all piecemeal, mixed up. So Vyasadeva sorted it out into separate books and taught the different books to different disciples. He organized it all. He's the editor. Vyas means editor. He didn't write anything. He just edited this disorganized mass of information. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur in Bhagavatam commentary gives an analogy. Like a rich man has a big treasury In his treasury, he has a lot of jewels. But they're in a mess, all mixed up. So he hires a reliable man to come in and put all the diamonds in one pile, all the rubies in another, all the sapphires in another, and the pearls in the fourth pile. That's like Vasudeva, who came in and sorted out the four kinds of mantras. They're already they're different, but he separated them out into different books. He edited them. That's what it means. Then he made one Veda into four. They're different. They're different kinds of mantras with different purposes. But they were all mixed up. They were all, you know, thrown together into one pile. That doesn't mean the pearl is a ruby. Pearl and a ruby is always, are always separate. But if you mix them up, you have, yeah, they're all over the place. They were mixed up, that's all. Because it's also said that Brahma created the beginning of creation, four separate Vedas out of his four different mouths. So they were different even at the beginning of creation. And we're talking about Vyasadeva in Dwarpa Yuga, much after the beginning of creation, separating them. But they were originally separate when they first came out of Brahma's mouths, but they got mixed up. They came out of his mouths, just like if you have sound vibration coming out of four loudspeakers, different tape, you know, you've got four different tape recorders blasting. Once it gets into the ether, the sound waves get all mixed up, and you just get cacophony. You know, the sound waves don't stay separated. You know, the sound waves bounce into each other and they just get mixed up. But originally, they're separate.
Why
Because Samaveda is considered the most devotional. Yeah. The Vedas, at least when you look on the surface, they seem to be just dealing with materialistic purposes, ritualistic purposes. Most of the Vedas seems to be just karmakanda. You know, praying to different demigods to get various material benefits. If you look under the surface, you'll discover a real devotional purpose of the Vedas, but that's sort of covered and hidden. But the devotional essence of the Vedas is closest to the surface, it's easiest to see in the Samaveda. Just like song, music, more than any other kind of expression, is very emotional, evokes emotion. So like that, the Samaveda very directly evokes devotional sentiment. Anyway, that's Krishna's choice. He says, I'm the shark among fish. It's just, you know, shark is the biggest and most powerful fish, so therefore Krishna identifies himself with it. And he also, out of the four Vedas, he identifies himself with the Samaveda. Yeah. Yes, they each got their own samhitas, their own brahmanas, their own aranyakas, and their own upanishads. Not only that, but each Veda comes in different versions. There are different branches of each of the four Vedas, and each branch has got its own books in each of those four categories. There's a Taittiriya samhita of the Black Yajur Veda, Taittiriya Brahmana, Taittiriya Aranyaka, and the Taittiriya Upanishad. And every other branch of every other Veda has got its own complete set of all four books. Not only that, there's more than one Upanishad for each Veda. It's hundreds, there's 108 or more Upanishads altogether.
How many of the total original books of the Upanishads are
remaining? A few hundred. You know, there should be theoretically thousands of them, 5,000 or more. And actually, we have less than 500 existing. That's natural. In Kali Yuga, only a small fraction of the Vedic literature is available in Kali Yuga.
Doesn't 5-10%? 5-10%?
Between 5% and 10% is still available.
And the rest of it, we just know that they exist.
Theoretically, but they're lost in Kali Yuga. And we can see, historically, how they're dying out. Nowadays, you're lucky if you can find 20 or 30 Brahmins who properly know how to chant the Samaveda, still left it anywhere in India. So if there's only a handful of people who can chant Samaveda at all, that means most of the Samaveda, 1,000 branches of the Samaveda have been lost. There's only a few left that are on the verge of going out of existence. Okay. Oh, yes.
Different
Vaishnav sampradayas? Yes. Yes. A source of the Vedas? Well, normally, according to the Puranas, and even the Purusha Sukta says that the Vedas emanated from the mouths of Brahma. And then the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it says that all the Vedas, etad mahabhuta shanishwasatam yadvig veda yajur veda atarva angrida sa, that the four Vedas and the other Vedic literatures originally are the emanation of the breathing of the Supreme Person. So originally, according to the Upanishads themselves, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it's the breath of Narayan from which the Vedas emanate. Then you can also say when Brahma creates the universe, the Vedas come out of his mouth. But that's not the original origin of the Vedas, that's just in the creation. And then Lord Shiva also, he's speaking Vedas, but actually what he's mostly speaking is the Tantras. You know, he's sitting with his wife, Parvati, and they're discussing Tantras. But he's also expert on Vedas, so you can say Vedas come from Lord Shiva, but it's not the first origin. Okay, let's go. Yeah, and one more. Go ahead.
Technically, all these Vedas, the Shruti, you can only pronounce them and understand them if you're
Vaishya. Yeah, you have to have Upanayanam.
Yeah.
Vaishyas and Kshatriyas and Vaishyas can take Upanayanam and also chant.
How would you harmonize that with the spirit of the issues of Vaishya?
Well, the Vaishnav opinion is that someone who becomes a Vaishnav is qualified to perform Vedic sacrifice. Therefore, we do yagyas, and we chant Vedic mantras, even though most of us are mlechas, not born as Brahmins. But if you take Vaishnav Diksha, then you're also qualified to chant Vedic mantras. Of course, we're giving out these books to people who don't have initiation. But the idea is, if they study it with the Vaishnav commentary, especially Srila Prabhupada's purport, then ordinary people will become Vaishnavs. And therefore, they'll become qualified to hear even the Vedic mantras. Anyway, the safeguard is that the Isha Upanishad is being presented with the Vaishnav commentary. And therefore, it's accessible. I mean, you could argue. I mean, even Baladeva Vidyabhushan agrees in his Govinda Bhasha on the Vedanta that a Shudra should not be allowed to hear the Vedic mantras. And he quotes in the Govinda Bhasha, a Shudra who's caught, you know, listening in on the sacrifice, you should pour lead in his ears. Yeah. So, but the thing is, who's a Shudra? Yeah. A Shudra is a materialistic person who's inclined to lamentation. Person who's addicted to sense gratification. If someone becomes a Vaishnava, he should never be considered a Shudra, no matter what his birth is. It's not distinguished by birth, it's distinguished by character. So if someone has saintly character, he should be allowed to study and even chant the sacrifice, even perform the Samaveda sacrifice, if he's a Vaishnava. We take the risk in preaching. It's like Ramanujacharya was ordered by his guru, I'm giving you this Vishnu mantra, don't tell it to anybody. You know, or you go to hell. And he immediately climbed on the Gopuram, Kanchipuram, at the temple, and announced to all the people, here's the mantra, in violation, direct violation of his guru's order. And he said, I don't care, I'll go to hell. You know, I have to share this mercy. So like that, you know, even though Krishna says don't reveal this knowledge to the faithless, the Prabhupada is being more merciful than Krishna by distributing Bhagavad Gita to the faithless and Isha Upanishad. Okay, we'll go to hell. But, you know, it's in violation of the order, so we'll go to hell. But we have to distribute this knowledge anyway. Okay. Anyway, I wanted to read one of these quotes. I was just giving this outline as a background. And so we were talking about Kardama Muni, how in his prayers he's exhibiting what the qualities of a Brahmin: honesty, humility. So a Brahmin, he minimizes material entanglement. He tries to live a simple life. And he looks to the absolute truth. He tries to dedicate his life to the absolute truth. So there's a nice discussion, brief passage, in the Shatapatha Brahmana, describing how a Brahmin acquires good qualities and the influence he has on the rest of human society, the good influence he has because of the qualities he develops. So this is the Shatapatha Brahmana is connected to the white Yajurveda, the other Yajurveda, not the one that we belong to. The Yajurveda where the mantras and the explanations are not mixed up, they're in separate books. And there is one branch of the Yajurveda, the most prominent, called the Vajrasayani, white Yajurveda, Shukla Yajurveda. You can read about the revelation of that Vajrasayani Samhita in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam. Yajnavalkya, he was studying with his guru, and he got a little proud and said, what about these other disciples? They're not smart. I'm better than the rest of them. And his guru got angry at him. He said, what are you so puffed up about? You know, I reject you. You should immediately regurgitate all the mantras I taught you. And so he did. He threw up all the mantras. And the other disciples were greedy to get the mantras, so they all took the form of pigeons, partridges, little birds, and they ate the vomit to get the mantras. And they were... Taittiriya is the word in Sanskrit. So that's the Taittiriya Samhita. That's a Taittiriya Samhita, the black Yajurveda. But after that, now he's lost all of his mantras. Yajnavalkya went, having been rejected by his guru, he went to worship the sun god and prayed, give me some other mantras that nobody has. I want some new mantras that have never been revealed from the Yajurveda. And so the sun god responded to his prayers, and the revelation of this white Yajurveda, Vajrasayani Samhita, was given to Yajnavalkya. So in the that white Vajrasayani version of the white Yajurveda has a brahmana called the Shatapatha Brahmana, 100 paths, very elaborate ritual explanation. Some interesting things in there about Brahmins and Kshatriyas. So one passage from Shatapatha Brahmana, chapter 9, section number 5. I'll read the Sanskrit English, and then maybe tomorrow or the day after I'll pass out a sheet so you don't have to worry about trying to write it down and memorize it. Sanskrit. Pragya vardamana chaturo dharman brahmanam abhinishpadayati brahmanyam pratirupacharyam yasho loka paktim loka pachamanas chaturbir dharmai brahmanam bhakti archaya chadanina chadyei.